Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Title. And he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Hello everyone and welcome to a very special edition of The Warm Down. Today marks the 50th anniversary of one of the greatest achievements in Manchester United Football Club's history, and that is this night at Wembley in 1968, and it is my honour and privilege to welcome one of my favourite people in the whole world, which is Alex Stepney. Alex, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about what that 1968 Cup Final win meant to the city of Manchester, the people of Manchester, English football, everything. I mean, you was there, man.
Yeah, it was an occasion that, obviously, I mean, it's been noted that it was 10 years after Munich. That we're in the final, and if we could win it, it would be a blessing that we could do that for everybody that was involved at the club at the time. But to reach the final, I think that was everybody's aim, obviously. But to play the teams we had to play and where we had to go and play and how we got there was a different story to what goes on today.
We spoke before. We did a little thing for Full Time Devils. You mentioned you played on a concrete pitch as well.
Yeah, well, you see, in those days, I mean, we won the league in 67, and to go into the European Cup, you had to win the league. There were no four places or anything like that. So once the draw was made, and obviously there wasn't as many teams as there is in Europe as today, but you got a chance of pulling a team that you could probably beat in the first round. When we came up against a team from Malta, Hibernians, who, unbelievable, that island, I think, is just full of Manchester United supporters. I mean, we arrived there, we won 4-0 at home in the first leg, so we went to Malta, and we landed there at the airport, and I've never seen it like it in my life. Honestly, we were like royalty. To be honest, it was like the wedding last week, you know what I mean? There was crowds lying in the streets all the way to the hotel, cheering, and I mean, it was just unbelievable. And then when we think, well, we won 4-0, yeah, okay, right. We went and looked at this pitch, and I'll tell you, it was just an ordinary football pitch with, well, no grass. It was like concrete with sand on it. And we had to, I mean, that's the first, I think, probably the first time I'd ever wore tracksuit bottoms, you know.
I've never seen any photos or never seen any video from that game.
No. And actually, their manager was a priest. It was incredible. But, you know, we knew we finished up drawing 0-0, to be honest. We knew all we had to do was get through the game. But a fantastic experience to go to Malta. And then, because the next round we had Sarajevo, which was the old Yugoslavia, of course. But no charter flights. The club wouldn't have any charter flights after what happened at Munich. And so we had a flight to Dubrovnik. And then we had an 8-hour coach journey through the mountains.
So the club, after what happened with Munich, didn't want to use private aircraft, and they wanted to use commercial flights.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, that's the way that they were thinking, you know. And amazing was the fact that, you know, in those days, every game was on a Wednesday night. You know, that was the issue. So we would always go on a Monday, because it could take so long, which it did. I mean, to get there, we'd train Tuesday and then play on the Wednesday night. And of course, and because that's not the only fact about it, I mean, we drew 0-0 there. We had a depleted team, actually, and they were a very hard team. They were, I would say, probably the dirtiest team that I played against, instead of Estudiantes, but they were hard, and we drew 0-0. And of course, we had that 8-hour coach journey back the following day. So.
And then the plane ride back, and then the game at weekend again.
And then the game, but that's how it was. I mean, it was. I mean, with a squad of what, 14, 15? I mean, and obviously you've got injuries, so you might only have. You know, there was only one sub anyway. Jimmy Rimmer was a substitute, so there was no other substitute could be used. It was just Jimmy Rimmer.
And then you got the quarterfinals.
Quarterfinals, come up against Gornik. We were pre-warned actually about a fantastic player that had forward called Lebanski, and we had the home game first. We won 2-0. I think Jimmy Ryan scored late on. I think if I remember, or Brian. Late on,
was it not a Brian Kidd goal?
It might have been Brian Kidd, but it was a bit of a deflection, or something like that. And we finished up winning 2-0. And of course, we went there, and when we got to Krakow, we stayed at Krakow in the Katowice, 6 inches of snow. Now, you're thinking, is this game going to go ahead? Doubt it. But the stadium was 105,000. The stadium, it was 16 below, and there was 6 inches of snow that had been actually squashed down. So we were playing like an ice rink, and the referee was Mr. Labello, who I could go further on. He happened to referee the final, but a law came out that season. As a goalkeeper, you could only move 4 steps, and you had to get rid of the ball.
Okay.
So it's 0-0, we're up against it, but you know, we're doing okay. I think 3 or 4 minutes from the end, they get a corner to my left. The cross come in, well, I come and catch it. Near enough the penalty spot, it was high. But I couldn't stop. And he blew up for foul.
Oh no.
Good. But I couldn't stop on the ice. And because eventually they had this free kick and it bounced about, hit bodies, and it went to the bounce and he put the ball in the back of the net.
Was that a nerve? 3 minutes was well, I was going to say, was that a nerve-wracking time then? Because obviously,
well, you can imagine
they get another goal, momentum, everything like that. We know how it goes down, don't
we? You can imagine 105,000 Polish supporters. You know, just going absolutely bananas.
Was there any away support trouble?
Oh yeah, we you probably get a couple of planes that went out.
Really?
Yeah.
That's insane. Really,
yeah.
Red Army having it
since
68.
Yeah. We have friends of ours used to go. It's like everything else. I mean. I suppose the players today, they know some of the fans because they travel here, there and everywhere. And, but that's how we had it, you know, but obviously in a very small scale.
Wow. And then we go to Real Madrid, the greatest team that's ever walked the face of the earth, by all accounts.
Well, okay, I mean they won it.
Apart from us, obviously.
Yeah. But they won it, five years on the top when it first started. And we had that one player that had come through that. Hento was a winger. I've got to be honest, we thought possibly we could keep it 0-0 half time. We're 3-1 down, and they absolutely were superb. And Amancio was their main player. Nobby was told to mark him, and I think he did. Not mark him in that way, but mark him bang.
See, we don't know about that side, or certainly my generation doesn't know about that side of Bobby Charlton. But he wasn't shy, was he? Oh, Nobby did. Nobby did, right.
Nobby, yeah.
We know about that side of Nobby.
Anyway, so Nobby basically put him out of the game in the second half, and Matt's team talk was incredible at half time because our heads were down, and he didn't say anything, he just tooted us. And just before the bell went, he said he got up and started laughing at us. I mean, man management. I mean, you couldn't imagine Fergie doing that. You couldn't imagine any manager doing that today. But he just started laughing at us, and we only had 10 minutes in those days. Yeah, half time. What are you doing? You know, you'd be attacking teams all season. You're letting me down. This is the biggest game of your life. Go out and enjoy yourself.
Enjoy yourself.
Go out and enjoy yourself. That's what he said. And he always said that. Go out and play, you know. You've got talent, use your talent. You know, nothing more about it. And of course, he said, but when the bell went, he just said, you get an early goal, you'll win the game. Because David Sander scored, and then unbelievable, you know, near the end. I mean, Bessie goes on one of his amazing runs. I mean, everyone's watching Bessie. He's beating player after player after player on the right wing. And then somehow, I mean, I don't think he's ever passed the ball. I mean, Bobby's always said, you know, he's running to places where in games and got in a shooting position, and he's shouting George, 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 and next thing he says, well, what a great goal. but the thing was, he actually passed it to Bill. Now Bill would never say anything. Bill wouldn't call for anything. He must have seen him and looked at him. And Bill, what was he, 17 years at Old Trafford? First team, survivor for Munich, puts us in the final with a side foot. Couldn't believe it. He never side footed the ball when he was playing centre half in front of me. No.
Let's talk about some of them personalities then before we get into the actual final itself. Let's start with Sir Matt. What's Sir Matt like as a manager? You talked about his man management there at half time. There's only affection. You don't really hear of Sir Matt losing his temper. You hear that he had a very strict philosophy of entertaining football. You've got, there's the famous quotes like, these people work hard all week, you've got to entertain them. Was that what he was like day to day?
Yeah, I mean, I only saw him lose his head once. And that, funnily enough, was in Sarajevo. Because they, like I said earlier, they were a dirty team. And the dressing rooms were more like a cricket pavilion up at the top of the stand. So you had to go up the steps, and you had this glass front. And as you went through the doors, we went to the right, they went to the left, and he stood in the middle, and he didn't swear, but he was really, you could see him fuming, calling them as he went in. But that's the only time I've seen. I
mean, calling the opposition as well.
Covering the opposition. Right. No, yeah. But there's one word for Matt: respect. That's what he believed in. Respect. If you've got respect, and you've built a family, you've got people who will work for you. You know, I mean, my actual first meeting with him was absolutely incredible. I mean, I didn't even know I was coming. I was going to sign for Manchester United. I mean, I played the one game for Chelsea on the Saturday, and on the Monday morning, Tommy Dock called me and Peter Benetti into his office and said, right, he said, I'm going to have to play. I've got the two best goalkeepers in the world. He said, I'm going to have to play alternate games. Now, if you think about it, that's what Tommy Docherty would say. But it wasn't a thing that you'd want. And he just said, well, you, Alex, Peter, you're fit now. You can play against Watford in the League Cup on Wednesday. Alex, you can play against Arsenal at the Bridge here on the next Saturday. And that was it. Went training, came back. Was told to go in to see him, and he said, come on, get me a car, and took me to the White House Hotel near Euston Station. I said, what am I doing here? He said, you'll find out. And I just sat in reception with him. I said, come on, what's happening? He said, just wait and see. And the revolving doors, Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy booked him. Shook hands, blah blah blah. He went and booked, they booked two rooms, and that was it. And the funny thing about it was, Matt obviously was in charge. You could know, even with Tommy, he knew, and they were both managers. Tommy, you come with me into my room. Alex, you go with Jimmy into his room. Because what am I going to talk to Jimmy Murphy about? I mean, I've never met him. He's trying to sell me Manchester United.
Jimmy?
You do realise you're going to be playing with George Best and Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law and Ben and David Hurd, David Sadler, Tony Dunn, and I'm going, there'll be stars in. And I knew that, you know what I mean? But he was so gentle and clumsy. Jimmy was, and you'll enjoy yourself, son. You know, you come up to Manchester and you really enjoy yourself with these lads. They're great lads. And of course, next thing, changed over. Matt comes in, Jimmy goes with Tommy Dunn. And he said, right, son, everything's sorted, blah, blah, blah. And I'll tell you what he said. He said, now, we paid a world record fee for you. He said, but we do not pay anything to players. Because that was illegal in those days.
Yeah.
That was illegal.
This was before the wage cap was abolished,
right,
wasn't it?
That's right. And it was just... and he said, but I'm going to give you this wage. What'd that do? You know, that was really double what I was getting.
So, at any point was you asked if you wanted to join United, or was you basically told, here's what's happening?
No, that was it. That was it. But, I mean, I'd seen the Busby Babes. You know, that was it. But, funny, when I was going to watch Chelsea, but the fact was, I can't believe that. I'm going to Manchester United. But I've never met them. I've never met one. I mean, I played 3 under-23s when I was at Millwall. But there was no Manchester United players, so I never knew anybody. And I turned up He said, right, Matt just said, okay, and it's sorted. But I had to come up to Manchester to sign because there was no fax machines or anything like that in those days. Because you know? That was it, basically. And he said, meet me on the train at Euston for 10 o'clock. Could be there for 9:30. Got there. And I'm thinking, I'm in the tube. I'm just living in South London. I'm coming in the tube. And everybody's reading, rush hour, the papers and everything. I'm on the back page, and I'm sat in the tube. But anyway, I got there, and I thought, what am I going to talk to them about? Matt and Jimmy Murphy in a first-class carriage, just a
all the way up to Manchester. And it was probably about 6 hours as well.
Well, about 3.5 hours.
Oh, was it?
About 3.5 hours. And I met them, and he just went, Matt, Jimmy, go get some newspapers. I thought, no, dude, I can waste a bit of time. He sat there. Put the papers out, and after about 10 minutes, he just did the expression. Went like, what's all that, son? Well, on the front page, that big was a Head and Shoulders picture of my wife. I'm not moving to Manchester.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to live in Coronation Street. Incredible. I said, boss, I said, I don't know. I said, so, like, media has got to. While I was. You know, they found out, and because they got to it.
That's not so far removed from today, is it?
No,
really?
No. And oh my God! Anyway, we arrived in Manchester, and David Meek, who was the Manchester Evening News report, was there. Done a bit with him, and then we went off to the club, signed up with Les Olive, and that was it. I went in digs. You know, just put not a hotel in digs with Jimmy Ryan and another young goalkeeper called Terry Paul, in this little house just around the back of Old Trafford near the railway road. And next morning, on the Wednesday, United were playing Blackpool in the League Cup away. And of course, I wasn't eligible anyway, so I had to go and meet them at the training ground at the Ship Canal. And got to be honest, Matt walked me to them. Introduced me, and everyone come and shook my hand, and what a fantastic way. I mean, when I went to Chelsea, you didn't get that. When I went to Millwall, you didn't get that. You know, these are my family.
And they, you think, was, that come from some art?
Yeah, everything. You know, and they got beat, but I went to the game, but they got beat, but irrespective of that, it was fun, because my first game was obviously City.
We mentioned Jimmy Murphy there, obviously, as well. Now, there was a massive double act, wasn't there, those two? Explain to us a little bit more about how that dynamic worked and how important Jimmy Murphy was to the day-to-day running of the club.
Well, Jimmy was a character in his own right. He was more of the lad's lad, if I can say that. Matt wasn't. Matt would enjoy your company and play cards with you and things like that. But Jimmy, he'd have a laugh and joke. He went a bit further. To just make you feel relaxed, you know. And what they used to do was absolutely simple. Because, I mean, obviously, whoever we were playing, if we didn't have a midweek game, we would have a practice match. Normally, sometimes, reserves against first team, or first team defence against, with the reserve forward, sort of, you know, that sort of thing. And what they used to do at the Cliff was, Matt would walk down one touchline. As the game's going on, and Jimmy would be over on him touchline, and that's what he do. And if you've done so, I suppose players out there have done something wrong, or they thought they should be doing that, they'd just say it. They wouldn't capitalise on it, you know, or tell them off. No, you know, keep playing, keep going, enjoying yourself. And that was it. That's how they worked. But within, when you're travelling anywhere, I mean, we only had cards. And we played crib, you know. That was a game. We organised crib competitions between us. And Matt and Jimmy used to come in and play with it. It was all in the competition, and it was good fun, you know. But the best thing about I think one of the classic things about Jimmy, we were on tour after we won the league in '67. We went all around the world. We went to America and Australia, and we were in New Zealand. And Jimmy liked his scotch. He liked his scotch and his cigarette. You know? And because I thought, well, we're in Christchurch, and like as lads do, you know, there wasn't It was after the game, and so we'd gone back to the hotel and we had a few drinks and like, and Jimmy was with us, like, you know, but obviously he'd gone to bed, and we could get up to a few pranks as players, you know, because it was, how can I say, it was easy going. They made it easy going for you. Of course, we walked past his bedroom door, and he left his breakfast menu out. Well, we ticked everything. we ticked everything for 6 o'clock in the morning. Right. And obviously, next morning we get up and we're having breakfast as a team, and you know, in a room, and he walks in, and he's just laughing socks off. He said, "Well, thanks, lad. I thought we enjoyed that."
So he takes it well as well.
Well, all the kippers, everything, blah, 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 blah. And then another waiter come in with toast and jam, and then come cornflakes, and then come breakfast, full set, the lot. And he just laughed. Now, well, that's class, isn't it?
Yeah, because there's a respect line, isn't there? But there's also the fact that he can take it as well.
He wanted to be part of it, you know. The setup, the lads enjoy the fun of it, because if you don't have that, and he's against it, all of a sudden you get a bit of a friction, you know, between him and the team. He never done that to me.
Well, there can be some seriously pressure situations, can't they, playing top level sport like this, and when you can release that, that's always a good.
Well,
thing.
That's right, but he, but between them, I mean. They always, I mean, if Jim had something to say to a player, he would just, on a training pitch, he'd just put him aside and just have a nice little chat with him. You know, wouldn't have a right go at him. He'd just say, "Look, you know, I think you could, you know, perhaps do this a bit better." That was all, I think. And obviously, you play for people like that. You work for people like that, you know. And it was always your Christian names and no matter where you were. And you saw the respect that each and, you know, Matt and Jimmy had was in the club, because whoever was on the staff or even the laundry ladies or whatever, it was always personal Christian names, and, well, you can't go wrong.
So Bobby Charlton.
Yeah.
The guy's career reads like a comic book, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know about a comic book.
A
Hollywood film, more than anything, because Bobby was, I mean, coming from the northeast, obviously.
From a football family as well.
Yeah, from a football family, but the thing was, you know, in those days, you couldn't join a football club until you left school at 15. Not like today, you know. So, obviously, I think Joe Armstrong, who was scout, and Jimmy had seen Bobby playing for England schoolboys and because obviously from Manchester United might have had some, you know, probably Newcastle in some ways or some, but the fact was that it was Manchester United, you know, he got the chance to join and join, and probably one of the best scoops that the club ever made, you know, back in the 50s. And that was what Matt's dream was, like youth football, and the amount of players that came through, and Bobby was such a massive part of it.
What was he like as a man? Because we can reel his records off, we can reel his achievements off, but what's he like as a man, as a player?
Bobby,
and
a lot of people, a lot of people think Bobby is a bit dour in respect, you know, he's straight laced and in respect, but he joined in. You see, because he was part of our family, which Matt had made, and he's obviously him and Bill Forbes were obviously the senior ones when I was at the club, and they made it all knit together, and Bobby did. I mean, Bobby would join in anything, and the best thing about Bobby, he kept scoring goals. You know what I mean? And his work rate was absolutely tremendous. I mean, you don't see that today. Even as him, as a lot of people, he's quiet. He wasn't. He was in the dressing room before the game, half time, on the pitch. he was having a, he was making us play. He was making, he was winning players to play.
That's the side we don't know, do we? As a modern, right. But he was a real proper leader.
Oh, he was a leader in every way, and of course, you know, the problem from my point of view, and might have been other players' point of views, I don't know, the younger players, was the fact that we didn't really know what he was going through, because our bill, you know, from the crash, but we never spoke about that.
Yeah, you mentioned this before.
You knew you couldn't do that, and actually it was the best thing, because I would, if that had been me, I wouldn't want, you know, my workmates to keep talking about it. It was about, we've got to do something about it. That was it. I think inside of every other player in the team was, we've got to do something about it, and hopefully we can.
And that was just some sort of like unspoken nod, wink, instinct that everybody knows within them, but no one said a word about it verbally.
It's surreal.
Yeah,
it was surreal to happen. And Bobby joined in. Loads of things. You know, I mean, even when I think, you know, we won the Five Aside tournament at Wembley, which was, I mean, he's there pushing us. Everything, and for him to break so many records was incredible. But like you say, you know all about that. But he was a family man.
You won't even say it now, will you?
Eh?
You won't even say the word now.
What?
Munich.
No, don't have
it. Does it feel taboo still,
I mean,
to say the word?
I talk about it because it was 10 years when we talk about the European Cup, but I don't have to mention it. You know. All I can say is, if people say to me, you know, outside supporters, and they mention it, well, my first reaction is, I know how good they were because I saw them play. You know, which a lot of people didn't, you know. A lot of people say about, you know, the players in that team, well, it was just, they were just unbelievable. And what Bobby did in his whole career is what those other lads would have done exactly the same or even better, we don't.
There was another couple of real tough leaders in that team. Probably more that I'm not really fully aware of, but two I want to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. So Bill Foulkes, as you mentioned, he survives Munich. He plays like the following week.
I
can't imagine that.
No, I can't. But he was a strong, solid, dour, and I mean dour guy. That probably helped him through, you know. I mean, even playing with him, like, he hardly spoke to you. You know, he was. You do that. Well, that was Bill, you know. And it was just solid, hard, but sometimes, you know, in games, I had to do something, because I remember we played Southampton down at the Dell. And those who can remember the Dell, it was a very enclosed ground. The crowd were
small,
very small, and they had a centre forward called Ron Davis, who was notorious for heading the ball, big, strong. So you can imagine these two up against each other. Well, actually, it was 1-1 at half time, and Ron Davis had got above Bill and put the ball in the back of the net, and he got up against it. He got up. Headed a few in towards me, which I saved, and I thought, Bill, you've got to do, you know, what's the matter? What's the matter? You know, I said, Bill, come on, give it to him. You know, so we went out the second half because the first cross comes in as they're going to do it, aren't they? They know Bill's under pressure, but he done his job, and next thing I saw blood from Ron Davis's head and his nose, and we win the game 2-1. But that's how it was, you know. He was a hard man, but a miserable.
He was.
I mean, Matt used to take us away, especially if we didn't have a midweek game. We'd go to Derby Barnes at Blackpool, and we'd go and play golf at St Anne's. Now, Bill was a good golfer. He was up one. And obviously, you eventually sometimes do play with him in a four ball, but I played with him once. He never spoke to me. He never spoke to anybody. He never spoke to anybody. And we're playing around the golf and trying to enjoy ourselves, and he, well, that was it.
And
that's why he was a winner.
Well, yeah, clearly. And alongside him, you had a little Mancunian Terrier, Nobby Styles. Should be Sir Nobby, by
absolutely,
the way.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And Nobby was, well, we had two nicknames for him. One was Crusoe. Like, you see, Nobby, wherever he went, if you sat down eating, well, you didn't want to sit next to him. Because you knew that he would knock a bottle over, he would knock something, he'd get some butter and it would go off and it would fly in your face. That was Nobby. And yeah, I mean, he didn't have his contact lenses in and things like that, you know. I mean, we called him Clouseau like Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther film. And we called him Happy because on the pitch he was a miserable son. Really, I mean, we played at City one game at Main Road, and I think Mike Doyle took a throw in on the edge of our box, and he had a long throw, Mike. Because I've come, and actually, I didn't get there. And it eventually went for a corner. I think Nobby. And I turned round, and he's like, imagine, he's what, 5'7"?
No teeth.
You don't do that again! And then it frightened my life out of me, you know. And it never happened again. I've got to be honest, it never happened again. But got in the dressing room at half time, and he just come up, Alan, I'm sorry about it, but you know, I did have to tell you. What's all about? But you've got to love him. You've got to love him, you know.
So in front of you, you've got those two guys stopping everything, that nearly everything that comes through.
Yeah.
You've got Sir Bobby in the middle.
Yeah.
We usually would have had the lawman up front, but not on that particular night.
No.
The star of the team, George Best. What's it like going on the piss with Georgie Best? You know the song. You must have done it.
George was the kind of guy that he was very shy. I don't know. Did you ever meet him?
I didn't have the pleasure, no.
You didn't have
the pleasure?
He was very shy. He was very intelligent. And I say to people, you know, when I talk about George and, you know, I say, look, remember George for 7-8 years playing for Manchester United from 1963 to probably 70. I said, that was the greatest player you'd ever see in your life. What happened after that? Can happen to anybody. He felt a lot of remorse of what happened at the club with Matt going and things that were happening. So he's gone that way. You know, life was, he was a fifth Beatle, and he had an agent then, and this is when it all started to move on, and he had businesses, didn't he? He had clothing businesses, he had pubs, he had bars and things like that. Well, he's gone. But remember George for those 7 years, I think, well, it was absolutely unbelievable.
We've seen the highlights, but there must have been so many times you've been watching that from your goal area and that haven't made it to TV, that we haven't seen. Describe him as a player for us.
Well, Steve, I do tell a story, and it's God's honest truth. What he used to do, I mean, because back then, we didn't have Sky. You know, you have matches a day, and that match might only be on for 25 minutes or something like that. There was just one match, that was it. There wasn't loads of matches. So you didn't really know about how teams played or how they set up and things like that. So it was, supporters probably won't believe this, but me, Paddy and George and Dave, and we used to go, I mean, it was ideal where we were. We could go and watch City, we could go and watch Everton, we could go and Liverpool were playing or Leeds, you know.
So you guys would go and like mob up in one of the ends together, like the whole United team?
No, we'd get tickets because we knew the players. And, you know, we'd get tickets and go and watch the games. And you'd weigh up. I mean, we went for the games. Like, you know, I mean, I would go and watch the goalkeeper. That's how I would cut it, what they did. Where George would weigh up how he could beat that defence. And this particular Friday, we were playing Liverpool at Anfield on Saturday, and after training, and on Friday we didn't do a lot of training, we would have a few sprints and, you know, get your body going again, and the five-a-side, and the manager would come out and pick the team, and that was it. And he came to Pat Paddy and I, and he said, I want to try this out. Well, what do you want? He said, well, look, he said, Bill Shankly's got this back four of Emin Hughes, Ron Yates, Tommy Smith, Chris Lawler. Tommy Lawrence was a goalkeeper. And they had a magnificent, in those days, they had a magnificent goals against record.
Mm. Well, that's a hell of a back five.
Yeah, at Anfield, dummies. But what George had noticed, probably I didn't really notice about it, but he said that that back four played high up to the halfway line. So that when any team tried to come over, if they would win the ball, they'd foul them or whatever. You know what I mean? They had a good defence. But George had pace. And that's what he said. I've got pace. He said, I can. If the right ball's played at the right time, I can beat this.
You know, just in a pure foot race.
Yeah. And he just said, right. He said, Alex, you go in that goal down there. All right? Paddy, you go in the old right half position as it was in those days. And now, he said, and face that goal.
Like a number six kind of area.
Yeah, yeah. Just face the goal. With the ball. He said, I'm going to stand on the halfway line, right on the touchline. He said, what I want you to do is turn, and with your second touch, knock a diving ball that's going to land 20 yards left wing. He said, when you've done that, I'm going to go, because he's in. He's in our half. So he's not going to be offside. Boom. Because he gets to the ball. Because Paddy was a great passer of the ball. Mm. But, and he said to me, do what you would do in the game.
Oh, so you're the goalkeeper,
I'm the goalkeeper.
For George, opposition goalkeeper.
I'm the opposition goalkeeper.
All right, so you're not playing it. I thought you was playing it.
No.
You're the opposition
I'm
keeper.
I'm in the opposition.
Got it.
Do what you do.
Clothesline him.
So he's coming at me. All right. Now, as a goalkeeper, I'm coming off my line. I'm trying to get my angles, but I'm trying to push him. I've got to push him wide.
Mm.
Can't. He's coming straight at me. The ball's never more than 6 inches from his toes. He's coming straight at me. What do you do? You get to a situation now, they don't do it today, but goalkeepers in those days, like myself, we used to dive at the feet, right? Go down head first, right? And as I went to dive, he toe-poked the ball. The ball hit my shin, bounced back to him, and he put it in the empty net. Now, he said, you didn't expect that, did you?
Wait, hang on, you mean he meant to play it off you?
Yeah, he said, you didn't expect that, did you? I said, no. He said, that'll do. We went to Anfield the next day. Oh, you done it deliberately, yeah? And we're kicking towards the cop end in the second half, and a cross come in. It was a corner, actually. And I took the corner. Now, whenever I got the ball, whatever they say about Paddy Creran, he was slow, he was this, that, and the other. He was always on the move, and he always found space. And I it was great for me.
Well, I've heard him compared to a modern, an old-fashioned version of Paul Scholes.
Yeah. He's always on the move, but he always wanted the ball. Because when I got this ball, I threw it to him. But like it was the day before in training, in the exact same position, right half position. And he controlled it, turned, and he hit this diagonal ball. The ball went between Ron Yates and Tommy Smith. Bestie's on his bike, gets in between Smith and Lawler, gets, now he's going at Tommy Lawrence at the cop. Emin Hughes is coming across, he can't get near him. Tommy Lawrence is doing exactly what I did. Because, dives at his feet, toe pokes the ball, comes straight back to him off his shins, and puts the ball in the empty net.
Right.
And then we're laughing, the cop.
I could have said, when he plays it off you, that was an accident.
No.
When he does it the next day,
yeah,
that's no accident.
No, it's no accident.
Oh my God.
That's what he did.
Oh my God.
Oh, and in those days, that had never been thought about.
Hang on, I just can't get my head round playing the ball off a goalkeeper's shin as he's coming towards you. The variables in that must have been huge.
Well, think about it, Steve. The fact is, in those days, all goalkeepers, we worked on angles. So I'm shutting his angle down. As I'm coming out to you, I'm shutting his angle down. So really, it can either go one way or the other, and at least you've still got a chance. But the unexpected, you haven't. And that's what he did.
And he did this pretty regularly.
Well, no, because
not that particular
moment. In training, he used to do it.
Just,
you know,
mad things.
With defenders and things like that, you know. He just done it. That's what he thought about.
George Best. Okay, so we get through, and we spoke before, and you said if you thought the name was on the trophy, the Bill Folk scoring, Bobby Charlton scoring, We've seen the photos, we've seen the emotion on people's face. Bobby Charlton looks, he almost looks distraught actually, getting through to the final from the Bernabeu. You played one game for England.
Yeah.
It was the week before the final. Why is there a final the week before the, a friendly the week before a European Cup final for starters?
I don't know. It was just, perhaps I never thought we were going to get there. That was it. But I mean, in those days, you see, the fact was that substitutes weren't, you know, I mean, there wasn't many friendlies. You know,
but they're having them in the middle of.
Yeah, there was no. Yeah, I mean, in the middle of May, I suppose, because that was on the 22nd of May, and then they had another friendly. Well, because how it turned out, we were in the Nations Cup.
Yeah.
And we had to go to Italy, but we had a friendly against West Germany on the Saturday after the European Cup won. So, but we weren't tired.
What's training like? Because we spoke before, and you said the team instructions that Sir Matt gave was in the tunnel at Wembley. Oh, Nobby, by the way, you're marking Eusebio. Now, when you said that, I didn't even think about it. But since I've thought about it, that's the World Player of the Year, roughly, at the time, Eusebio. Yeah. That's the literal equivalent of the current Cristiano Ronaldo, isn't it? And the manager's literally just saying, as you're walking out, oh, by the way, you're marking him. Yeah. Are you telling me you didn't work on that in training the week before?
No. It was... Whether he'd said anything to Nobby in training, I wouldn't know.
Because he just does it man to man.
He does it man to man. But because he said it as we were going out for the dressing room, going into the tunnel, he's letting all of us know what Nobby's doing.
Right.
That's how it works.
You've said in an interview previously, with the old tunnel location at Wembley and the fact that they had that the dog track around it and everything like that, that's a long walk to the halfway line, and then obviously you've got the national anthems and all that sort of stuff before, and that's when the nerves get you.
Yeah, I think
talk me through walking out there.
I think the thing, once you leave that dressing room and that tunnel wasn't a glorious tunnel like they've got at Old Trafford now.
It was just a hole, wasn't it?
It was dank, and there was both team coaches in it, and you know, there was people walking about, and then as you come down, and it was quite steep actually, and then there's a guy standing there, you know, an official, Bob, and you stand there because the band, you can hear the band playing, you know, Coldstream Guards, whoever it was, you know, playing, both teams up, and you don't really say anything, you know, to them, and you stand there and right, and you have to walk across the dog track. Then there was a sand sort of area.
Because it was an oval, wasn't it? Sand
behind the goal, and you walk past the goal, and you had to go, and you were told this before, you know. I mean, you know, you were told where to stand, everything, and that was it. And that's when...
Doubt, yeah. Nerves.
Well, I think that's killed quite a few players, especially in cup finals, any cup final really. It's not like being in a dressing room and going straight on the pitch. It's that wait and realise it. And 100,000 people. Well.
Pomp, ceremony, all that kind of stuff. Did you have someone come and greet you? Is it usually royal family or someone?
No, not for the European Cup. It was FIFA. FIFA.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
So the game starts?
The game started, funny enough, the referee was Labella.
Yes,
he pulled me up in Gorney. And I know he's Italian, but I just looked at him and I said, do you remember Gorney?
Four steps.
The game starts and it was okay. I don't think it was a classic. I mean, both teams are going to go hell for leather anyway. And they obviously wanted their revenge because they got beat 5-1 at home, didn't they?
That was the El Beetle time,
that's
wasn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
When George Best came on with the sombrero and that.
That's right. Of course, I think they were... What Nobby was going to do, basically mark Eusebio. I don't know who was marking George, but I think a few of them were trying to have a dig at him, you know, and... that was how it was planned out the first half, really. I mean, we had two or three chances, I think, but they had a chance. I mean, Eusebio hit the crossbar, and a free kick I saved, but that was it.
This is cup finals though, isn't it? You're talking about two of the best teams in the world at the time. Mm. Cup finals, they're always like that. They're always tense. There's always chances for both sides. There's always ebb and flow, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. But I think that the best thing from our point of view was we had a player who wasn't notoriously known.
Johnny Aston.
Johnny Aston. You know, he never played for England. You know, he had been in and out the team. And he made his mark coming up to the final, but they didn't know about it. I'm sure they didn't know about it. And John did what he always did. He went out and done what he wanted to do, and that's coming back to what Matt would, you know, go out and enjoy yourself. Go and play. You've got the talent, and that's what he did. And he tore, Adolfo, I think, he actually tore him to pieces.
Well, he was man of the match, wasn't he?
He was man of the match, and the fact is that we didn't realise for a while, but what he was doing, it made our game change plan, because for the simple reason, give it to John, because he's tearing apart. You know, that's how things happen in the game. And because of that, if you think about it, I don't want to go too far, but if you go into the, you know, even the extra time, he put a corner in, but Bobby scored him, from the right hand side.
So it is 1-1 with, there's that famous save from yourself.
It's famous, I don't know.
It's pretty famous. You can't imagine it's famous, but it's pretty famous. Okay. So, we've spoke about how hard a shot Eusebio had, knock you off your feet.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is the famous clip of Eusebio coming and applauding you and it sinking in and coming back and applauding you.
It was
the game hinged on that moment and then into extra time. Mm. What gave Manchester United the lift in extra time over them? Because we came out and blew them away and it was done.
Well, it was. I can remember. Just don't forget. I mean, I'm the goalkeeper. I'm back there. I'm not doing the amount of running as like. Well, you know, you're more. How can I say, reflexes and well, I'm the puppeteer. I'm more of an organizer. That was my. That was what I believe my role was. And obviously, if I made the saves, I made saves, and my distribution was had to be good. That's what it was about. But when the final whistle went after 90 minutes, because we went to the halfway line and Matt came out and Jimmy and Ted Dalton, who was a physio, and Jack Compton, the trainer. And of course, Wembley in those days was very lush. You know, there's not many games played on there, and it sapped a lot of energy out of you. A lot of players got cramped. Even, you know, it's been seen in cup finals years and years and years that it's happened. And I just remember someone said something to Paddy, and basically you think we're tired? Have a look at them. And they were exactly the same. They were absolutely on their knees. Because don't forget, it was probably 90 odd degrees in the stadium, and humidity as well. Mm. And of course, whoever's going to make the first break, whoever scores the next goal is going to win it, because you'd be depleted. And it was ironic that Tony Dunn threw the ball back to me, because he wanted to keep it safe, and I threw the ball to Shea and he gave it back to me, and I had to kick it. I always like to throw the ball out of me, because Brian got a flick on and George nutmeg Calhoun went round the keeper. Directly that goal went in, that was him gone, you know. And it's amazing, you know, they talk about scientific things in football today and mind games and all this. Direct that goal went in.
Did you know? Did you know that goal goes in, and did you see them deflate?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying. That's you can see. Just waste went like that. So now, you know, thing was, we went up. All out of, I mean, Bobby, what was he, 30, 34, 35? I mean, he was running like anybody. And it was incredible how it evolved that we were so far better than them. I mean, I had hardly anything to do, which is great.
So we've obviously all seen the celebrations, and I love the fact that the first thing on everybody's mind is to go and hug Sir Matt.
Yeah.
Is that your own first thoughts as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was, like I said, we never spoke about Munich, but we knew how much it meant, or this was going to mean if we won it. And during that final whistle, we all went to Bobby, Bill and Matt. No one, I mean, I can't remember him coming up to me, only when I got to the halfway line after I'd done what I had to do, that, you know, we loved each other and enjoyed it. But we all went to hug them. Amazing.
Do you remember anything anyone said from that moment, or is it just a complete blur now?
No, I think it was, if I can, I'll be honest with you, myself was, when do we go up and get that cup?
You're second in line as well, aren't you, behind
Sir
Bobby?
Yeah, when do we go? And because they had to go up first. And that was an anxious moment. That was an anxious moment, waiting to go up there.
You know you're getting it. It's coming.
But, yeah, but you know, those steps are not very wide. And because the crowd are there, and because it's full of red and white scarves.
Yeah.
And you imagine the supporters were saying to you as you're going up. And the funny people said to me now, you know, even today, you know, when Bobby received the cup, he took it off on his own. Now they pass it down the line. Why didn't I say, well, we've never done that.
And obviously there's all the scenes, everyone running around Wembley.
Well,
doing
then that's what you do. I mean, you do the exact thing of respect for everybody to go around with the trophy.
Anything that Sir Matt said in the aftermath, or when you got back in the changing rooms, or is it just time to get on a beer?
No. It was quite, I mean, I think it epitomises what a great man he was in respect of. I can only say this, is he had an amazing memory for names. And I believe Alex Ferguson, was exactly the same. Because we were in that dressing room. I mean, there was no interviews like you get today or anything like that. You just want to get in the dressing room. And while we were in there, because you got the champagne in the cup and the cup and this, you got a glass and, you know, we smoked, most of us smoked. Yeah, well, that was it. And then the door opened. And my brother walked in. Now, my brother was 15 years older than me. So he's in his early 40s. Yeah. How did you get here? That was my first, what are you doing in here? And he said, I couldn't miss this, he said. I jumped over the dog trap, jumped over the I mean, the cockney, you know, right? Up to the guy at the edge of town. I said, my brother's at the final, I want to see him. Yeah, well, I want to let him come in. And you imagine that today? Of course.
Can't beat a jibber.
Matt says, who's this? I said, no, it's my brother, Eric Boss. Oh, my brother, that was it. Come on. 77? Win the cup, FA Cup. We have a dinner at the Midland. We're invited to take guests with us, the club. Matt has never seen him since. Came straight out to him, Eric, how are you? Bang.
He saw him once in one of the most craziest nights and remembered
he
it.
He said to my brother, Eric, how are you?
Wow.
And I mean, unfortunately, my brother's not with us anymore, but he lived down in Eastbourne. Whenever I went down to see him, or you know, and we had a family reunion, he spoke about that every time I met him.
It's quite amazing to have that recall.
Yeah, and he used to tell me, I mean, I went to, you know, Danny, he used to play bowls, green bowls, and not crown green, but bowling at his club, and I went with him, you know, when someone went down, and he's in there, and he's telling all his mates, he's like, my brother, and he's on about, well, forget about me, he's on about Matt Busby. how he spoke to him.
Alex, this has been an absolute privilege. Thank you very much. I just want you to leave us on one thing. What did being European champion mean to you?
What does it mean? I think I've said it quite often, I don't think I realised, or we realised, what we'd done. 50 years, you're interviewing me, it's in the press, the club, it's just a wonderful thing that's happened in my life. I'm very lucky to be part of Manchester United.
Alex, on behalf of, you know, everybody that's watching this video, thank you very much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Thanks to you guys for watching at home. I hope you've enjoyed that as much as I've enjoyed sitting here and talking football with Alex. We could do this for hours, I'm sure. Alex, again, once again, thank you very much. Cheers.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all.